Chapter 7. Umbrooster was restless, eyes flitting about warily as he ground his teeth, only half concentrating as the hunter loped along at speed. Despite the combat, there was still no satisfaction to be had. The daring sabotage, the murder of his former allies, the ensuing destruction of the base at his hands, it had all been too easy, and he couldn't put his finger on why. Umbrooster feathered the trigger, absently sending stuttering bursts of machine gun fire into several small groups of armed civilians too dumb to hide fast enough upon hearing his approach. He didn't check to confirm hits. He knew they went down, chopped into burst bags of blood by accurate 8mm FMJ rounds. No, they were irrelevant. The priority now was figuring out why he still felt empty inside. Unfulfilled. A lone bike shot out from a side road as Armbruster stomped past, intent on ambushing him, spraying wildly with machine guns. The hunter reacted with lightning speed, thrusting out with a clawed foot that caught the bike squarely on the side. It spiraled into the air with a metallic crunch, sailing away from him, and Armbruster yelled, "Pull!" just like he saw on an aged vid from old Earth once, then blasted it with his railgun. The bike disintegrated into a glittering cloud of jagged shrapnel as the slug punched deep into a habitation block several hundred yards down the street, and Armbruster chuckled at the distraction. Then it hit him. He felt no satisfaction because the Corvids, or whatever the rabble called themselves this week, were not skilled opponents. And his former comrades had not expected a fight. They just lined up willingly to be killed like drugged-up pigs in a slaughter farm. There was no challenge to be had here. His skill was not being tested. Armbruster nimbly sidestepped as another bike, the first guy's companion no doubt, barreled at him at speed, seeming to aim directly for the skinny mech's legs, maybe hoping to topple the hunter onto the deck. His torso rotated as the bike missed, and Armbruster put a precise burst of fire through the plexiglass cockpit, perfectly compensating for the speed of the whole sorry affair. He didn't check the bike's demise, but heard it crash into something hard with a mighty grinding thump of metal meeting concrete. Another meaningless kill. "What I need to do," he thought to himself, "is investigate those things that fell from the sky." Half of him thought they were simply rockets, fired by an opportunistic enemy from a neighbouring city, no doubt going through the same motions as Solo Nobri. But half of him dared to hope that they were something else. With this in mind, Armbruster checked his map boards, made a mental calculation, and headed towards the necropolis at top speed. It took several hours to reach District HQ. Nobody had said anything for the longest time, and the only sounds on the net were occasional grunts when somebody needed to hand Bader over. They made best speed, Moggs going at full pelt to keep up with the punishing pace laid down by Eddie. The much smaller machines had great difficulty maintaining their rate of advance, as much due to the fact that Mog drivers were literally walking, their suits interpreting movements and copying them with artificial musculature, as with their size. The captain, by comparison, was a true pilot, sat in her command pit, a machine controlled by a combination of mind impulse and lever controls. For her, it was considerably less taxing. Any semblance of formation was lost, and the whole QRF was strung out in a haphazard convoy, grouped dangerously close together while Eddie forged ahead. In the wake of the base sabotage, it seemed that a reckless streak had been born in their commander, one that they hoped wouldn't get them killed. It felt eerie when they had passed through the sector gate, unopposed this time, surrounded on all sides by the featureless perimeter wall. It was the first time that Kinney had left the sector since the start of his tour. He felt like they were stepping into the unknown, figuratively and literally. That sector they left behind now felt like a part of an earlier era, a time of fleeting peace that would be marked down as an interesting footnote in some historian's research. The next sectors were much like the ones that Kinney, Carlos and Bader had grown up in, a sprawling mess of high-rise blocks and industry, all built on top of each other in a morass of human endeavour. Huge pipelines cast shadows over population centres, sometimes boring holes straight through the large buildings, as it would have been cheaper than building around them. The only thing missing was the people. These sectors were usually teeming with life, but as Kinney walked he could see only fleeting glimpses of the civilians, flashes of yellow, lone survivors and small packs moving from cover to cover in the distinctive rainmaks that were issued to each and every citizen. Those drivers nearest to Eddie tried their best to cover the flanks of the convoy, but a combination of speed and fatigue made the job difficult. The convoy had set itself into a sort of rhythm as it advanced through burning streets and buildings holed by weapons fire of various calibres. Kinney saw a family, mother, father, and two kids by his guess, huddled in their living room on a ground floor apartment, gripping each other tightly. Their home no longer possessed a front wall, and they were exposed to the rain as they shivered in yellow against the cold. Eight bright eyes stared at his mog as the convoy passed, blank expressions on dirty faces. Kinney was quickly becoming accustomed to the sight of shock on a person, and knew that they would be unresponsive for some time. An unspoken command had rippled through the unit. Every mog driver took turns to hold each of Bader's hands, one driver on each side, effectively pulling him along. Usually, if a mog driver becomes incapacitated, in the absence of a recovery vehicle, another driver can link up to his suit via a thickly insulated slave lead, so one trooper takes on the cerebral load of two suits to get them back to a safe zone. A cursory check of Bader's heat-damaged suit had confirmed Kinney's suspicions right away. The slave socket was melted. So they dragged him onwards. To Kinney, he was reminded of a time when he must have been little more than 5 years old. Carlos, Bader, and himself had been playing out in the deads when they noticed it was getting dark. The young boys had lost track of time. They weren't meant to leave the block when their parents were working the mines, but boredom had got the better of them that day. The three children had held hands, gripping tightly in a little line, wandering the alleys until they stumbled into a pack of miners coming off shift. Luckily, the men had recognised the boys and took them home, but Kinney had never felt so scared in his life. He never wondered again after that. Reynolf gave his friend's hand a comforting squeeze that wasn't returned, and his opposing number indicated that he wanted to change. When one trooper became tired, he simply gestured to the next in line to take his place before surging up the convoy, taking position to cover the flanks. In truth, both patrolling at speed and dragging Bader were similarly taxing, but the comforting routine of doing something useful helped to steel the tired soldier's resolve. It was somewhat miraculous that Bader was still standing in his present condition, and Kinney broke character to thank the saints for his continued survival. Kinney gave Bader's hand another squeeze without thinking, then wondered if it was actually for Bader's benefit or his own. As he pondered this, they trudged on. By the time they had filtered through the third sector gate, the novelty of passing them had worn off. The convoy gave a wide berth to the gargantuan, still-burning corpse of a command tower that sat, ominous in death, in the middle of the narrow highway between sectors. A literal mobile fortress, it had apparently died defending its gate, surrounded as it was by the broken and ruined shells of enemy vehicles. The once proud machine stood nearly 100 feet tall, dwarfing even Eddie in its reduced majesty as a funeral pyre. Kinney wondered what in the seven hells could have the power to destroy such an incredible feat of human engineering. He hoped not to find out. They had passed through three full sectors without incident. Evidence of fighting was everywhere, as though every sector had erupted into violence simultaneously, which Kinney figured was exactly what had happened. Bodies littered the streets. Some relatively intact, others little more than gobbets of meat strewn across a wide space, tatters of shredded yellow material among the mess the only thing marking them as human remains. In Sector 76, a pile-up of hundreds of civilian cars had occurred. The panicking population no doubt tried to flee via the gate and found themselves trapped in a choke point. Most of the vehicles were now burnt out as the convoy approached. Eyeless sockets stared from grinning, blackened skulls, their bodies partially fused with car seats. The vehicles were jammed so closely together, the people hadn't been able to open doors to escape the flames. Kinney felt sick to his stomach, as he noticed that the charred roofs of many of the vehicles were punctured in multiple places. They had obviously been hammered by high-caliber shells from above. Mechs had done this, or grav tanks. Something that could fly, maybe. Whatever it was, that kind of tech was owned primarily by the army, and Kinney tried not to imagine rogue soldiers pouring incendiary rounds into gridlock traffic. He failed. The convoy had stopped while Eddie surveyed the scene. Kinney looked at the skyline, hidden behind yet another sector wall, towards the centre of the city. It appeared as though everybody with a gun was heading there, drawn like moths to a flame as the horizon burnt ever brighter. Tracers laced the sky with increasing frequency, and if he strained, the Mog driver could make out the sounds of gunfire and explosions over the walls. "There's no way around," Blake said, after carefully considering her options. "We need to go through this." She took the first step and cringed. The cheap stamped metal shell of the civilian car offered practically no resistance as she ground it flat. It was nothing like stomping on tanks. There was no threat here, nothing alive even, and that somehow made it worse, that the people inside the cars were allowed no respite in death. They would be defiled by the awesome weight of her war machine, and all because she needed to get somewhere fast. She stepped on another one. It was impossible not to, they were packed so tightly together. Blake kept her pace slow as Eddie crushed the traffic jam and watched her minuscule rear display carefully. The Mogs were having a harder time of it. Kronig simply smashed the cars with blows of his weapon arms, the thin material no competition for his armoured bulk, to allow him to more easily walk over the things. Some of the others tried to clamber atop the cars, clumsily hoisting themselves up with futile motions, for as soon as they put any weight on the burnt husks, they crumpled like cardboard boxes under the hefty suits. Blake's eyes shot across to scrutinize the main display and zoomed in on a portion of the sky up ahead. Rocket contrails again, in formation no less, streaked down from above in a diagonal curve. Blake estimated where their trajectory would take them as they were chased by flak shells fired from wherever that burst in dark veils of spinning fragments. The effect reminded her of a particular kind of fungus that puffed out clouds of spores when disturbed. The fungus grew all over the city. It thrived in a dirty environment and caused no end of respiratory problems amongst the old and infirm. "I think these clouds are slightly more deadly," Blake thought absently, as she factored in orbital gun density across the city and realized she knew where they would touch down. The Necropolis. Part crash site, part shrine. The Necropolis was where the original settlers, led in time by Martim, Nara, and Blessed Eatim in spirit, had landed. The huge colony ships, each up to a mile in length, had made a controlled crash in an unknown wasteland, and it was from there that the Saints led their people to prosperity as an independent world, free of corporation rule. Because of this, because of the massive importance of the site to religious leaders and pressure from the hierarchy, Great Leader had never put orbital guns directly on the site. It appeared as though the hierarchy were about to be bitten in the ass by their decision. Blake opened a channel. "Spacers! 12 o'clock high!" She tried to get a fix with her rangefinder, was offered only wildly fluctuating numbers, and thought about the distance to the Necropolis. "Roughly 4 to 5 miles. "What in the seven hells are spacers?" said Markovich from Second Squad. "Spacers, private, are one of the many cultures that comprise the galaxy at large. They probably heard about the contract and are here on an asset grab." "Should we be worried, given the level of shit we're currently buried in?" Morante queried. It was understandable for anybody without outside experience, but unlike Morante, Blake had seen footage of spacers in combat. "We most definitely should. Spacers are aristocratic by nature, arrogant and ruthless. They'll kill anyone who stands in their way without a second thought if we let them." "There's a lot of that going around," said Kinney. "What makes you so sure they're spacers? Don't most of mankind fly about in spaceships these days?" Kronig answered on Blake's behalf. "The contract was only issued a few hours ago. Spacers live in space. Use your damn head, private." "Thank you, Sergeant. Spacers are the only void-travelling force that could reach us within such a short time frame." She eyed the rapidly descending contrails again and saw parts flake away from them, like the outer husks of cocoa seed pods, a rarity on Novo Solo. "Drop pods, I think they're called," she went on, as Eddie slowly tromped along the overcrowded highway. "They'll probably contain weapons we've never seen before." There was no point sugarcoating it for the troops anymore. They had to be aware that they should expect the bizarre. Eddie stepped onto solid ground, and Blake gave a cursory glance to her rear display once more. The Mogs were right behind, no doubt grateful to be away from the dead traffic. She could only imagine what it looked like from their point of view, and didn't envy them in their power suits back there. "Shake out into formation," Blake ordered. "Second squad up front, first in reserve. First squad, take control of Private Bader and be ready for anything." A chorus of confirmation sounded across the net. There was no telling what could be out there waiting for them, and that bastard Arm Brewster was probably lurking out of sight, stalking from the shadows. Sergeant Kronig was undoubtedly good in a fight, but Morante's squad were whole, and she put more value in coherency than individual fighting skill at that moment. As they fanned out and prepared to advance, the low rumble that had been the heartbeat of the city for hours now began to coalesce into individual sounds. It took her a moment, but Blake increased her audio gain and recognized them for what they were. The sounds were gunfire. So many weapons discharging at once that it overlapped into a sonic assault, a pure deluge of noise. Being a career soldier, Blake had been used to the sound of weapons fire her entire life. She thought of how many weapons would be required to fire at once to make her lose recognition upon hearing them, and she did not like the answer. They were getting close now. This sector bore the scars of battle much more than the previous sites they had visited on their way through to District HQ. Many buildings were little more than rubble, twisted skeletons of rebar and shattered concrete clutching at the sky. Not that Kinney was paying attention anymore. He was tired, and had injected himself with a small dose of stims to keep going. Kinney rotated his torso and looked across at Braga, who held Bader's other arm. Mog drivers could not see each other's faces, but over time learned to recognize their comrades' moods via body language. Braga looked frustrated, shuffling in place, clearly just as tired as Kinney. He tugged Bader's hand to keep him moving, and his friend said sorry about his slow speed. He kept apologizing, and Kinney kept telling him that it was no bother. No bother at all. They would be at District soon, and probably in for the fight of their lives, but at least they would be able to rearm and get Bader to some medical attention before being thrown into the meat grinder. It made Kinney's bones ache just thinking about it. He felt like he had doubled in age over the course of the previous few hours, and he could not fathom how the positively ancient Kronig kept going. Combat as a Mog driver was tough, make no mistake. Kinney's arm jarred painfully, and he looked behind him to get Bader moving again. "Come on, buddy, it won't be long now." But Bader squeezed his hand hard and said with surprising clarity, "Brother, look at that." Kinney looked to his front, and it was like staring into the hells themselves. District HQ was under siege. Higher than even the perimeter wall, the sheer concrete surface was laced with razor wire across its entire surface. Thousands of muzzle flashes and glittering beams of energy weapons speared down from the battlements dotted along the top of it, pouring like rain onto the attackers below. The Corvids, an entire army of them, advanced at a snail's pace under torrential ordnance. Huge shield generators were pulled along by armored tractor units. They crackled and sparked, giving off a fitful blue light that made it difficult to focus under its irregular strobe effect. Beneath this bubble of protection, infantry and armor of all varieties advanced. The shield umbrella wasn't perfect. A veritable shit ton of fire was getting through, and the army left a trail of bodies and wreckage in its wake as it continued its grim advance. As Kinney looked, a heavy artillery round fired from a type of vehicle he had never seen before detonated perfectly on top of the wall. Chunks of masonry collapsed down the frontage, and Kinney could see men and machines tumble to their deaths. The focal point, the spot that the entire force was aiming at, was a breach. The wall already had a gaping hole blown in its immense frontage. Plugging the void was a command fortress. Through the constant flickering and huge weight of gunfire, at first Kinney thought it was out of action, burning like its cousin back at the gate. But as they advanced, insanely, towards Armageddon, he could see that it was very much alive. It was simply firing all its armaments at once. Artillery boomed from its back, lobbing HE shells into the hordes below. Main cannons tracked the shield generators, thumping in rhythm, trying to knock out the enemy's formidable protection. The explosions bloomed like deadly flowers, causing the hard shields to ripple fiercely, waves of energy cascading across the irregular surface. The fire appeared to be ineffective, but everyone knew that shield power was finite and it was simply a matter of attrition. Even as Private Kinney formed the thought, one of the generators popped with an almighty backwash that blew through the Corvid ranks in a gale. Before they had time to react, small arms turrets opened up on the fortress's lower tiers. Scores of infantry and light vehicles, which had just enjoyed nearly impenetrable protection moments before, were mown down in buzzing streams of tracer. Other shield units were converging upon the entrance, and Kinney could see that soon the gap would become meaningless as all units reached the spear point of their attack. District HQ would fall. What can we do to stop this? Surely the MPA is done. Well, they're screwed, Markovitch said, seemingly reading Kinney's mind. Can we go home now? Despite the situation, Reynolf couldn't help but laugh. Kronig was in no mood, though, as his growling words attested. We need to offer support right now. We can hit them in the rear. Disrupt the attack if we move now. With what exactly? Morante contested, her words failing to hide a humorless laugh. We've got small arms and our bodies to add to that fight. You think those tanks and heavy guns are going to just give up because we're the good guys? Kinney frowned. He couldn't believe he was about to say this. I agree with the sergeant. His stomach twisted in knots as he spoke. We need to help them. I can't watch more of our guys die. But what if Carlos is out there, advancing with the Corvids? A voice said in his head. He could worry about that once they got inside District HQ. His immediate concern was Bader. He couldn't just go around assuming his brother was in every Corvid group out there. Besides, we're from the other side of the city. I'm sure he's fine, Kinney lied to himself. I don't care what's going on, added Markovitch, his voice pitched slightly too high. I'm jacked off me tits on combat stims. Shut the hell up, Marco, snapped Mirante, but a few sniggers over the net took the impact out of her words. Listen up, kids, Blake said. There was an authority to her tone that wasn't there before. I'm not interested in what any of you want to do. I've just had orders from headquarters. We are to proceed east, skirting the perimeter of HQ and approach via the hydroponic farms. It is currently the only flank not under attack, so it is the only entrance that can be opened. Any questions? She waited about a second. No? Good. Corporal Morante, move. And they stepped off the main road to weave among the cluttered streets of Sector 70.